It's 1900 UTC, and that means it's time for That's News to Me. I'm your host, DJ Marcus. Let's see what's happening in the world today.
Alrighty, welcome. It is October 21st, 2020, and it's time to talk about some news. We're going to start off with
world news.
That's right. Let's see what's happening. This is a disturbing story. Basically, we've been covering protests against police brutality in Nigeria. Yesterday, we talked about a lockdown coming. Well, it's been really bloody and terrible. Our friends at the World Socialist website pick us up here with Nigeria's government has unleashed deadly violence against the anti-police brutality protests that have rocked the country for nearly 2 weeks. On Tuesday night, it sent in soldiers firing live ammunition to massacre peaceful protesters and quell a movement that has posed an increasingly direct challenge to the rule of the corrupt bourgeois state, headed by the former general and coup leader, President Muhammadu Buhari. Social media posts showed protesters killed and wounded in the military attack on a large crowd that had blocked the toll gates at the Lekki Ikoyi Bridge, paralyzing an expressway that links Lagos Islands with the Lagos mainland in Nigeria's sprawling commercial capital city. While the scale of the massacre was not immediately clear, one witness reported to BBC that he had seen at least 20 bodies and more than 50 wounded. Before the troops moved in, they cut off the lights and the CCTV camera at the toll plaza. There were reports that troops were carrying away bodies to hide the extent of the death toll, while one medical professional reported that wounded were being evacuated from a nearby hospital for fear that the army would come to round them up and kill them. Lagos authorities Tuesday announced the imposition of a 24-hour curfew across the city of 20 million, declaring we will not watch and allow anarchy in our state. Previously, the Nigerian army warned it was prepared to step in against subversive elements and troublemakers. So, very, very disturbing indeed. Oh, welcome. Welcome, Publius. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks, SMJ, for joining up. And we'll look forward to, let me know if your letter to the editor makes it to publication. I'll read it on the show. We'll have an SDF for making the news. And welcome, X1, also, and Zeptar. So, yeah. Yeah, I don't know what the Fort Worth Star-Telegram had on the cover, but Publius has written a letter to the editor, and I hope it gets published. It'd be really neat to read. All right, keep on a rolling here. We'll jump over here to Berlin. Oh. X1 and Zeptar, in comm. I take this second to mention, if you do want to interact, this show's live almost all the time. And when it is live, you can join COM by SSH over to SDF and type COM, C-O-M, hit enter. That'll launch the chat program. Press G for go to. Type out a non-radio, all lowercase, all one word. Hit enter, and you'll be taken to the Anon Radio room where you can chat with other people who are listening or were recently listening to a show. It's a good time. It's good fun. Be sure to check it out. And after this show, at 19:30 UTC, every day of the week, you can catch the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe. And that's a fun 30-minute show, kind of exploring all sorts of stuff. Golf balls, ancient Chinese secrets, what 409 is good for, lots of fun stuff. All right, so back to the news. Berlin has an odd bit of news today. At least 70 artifacts were sprayed with an oily liquid on Berlin's Museum Island, a UNESCO World Heritage Site that is home to five famous museums. The attack took place on October 3rd, the anniversary of German reunification. German reports have speculated whether supporters of a far-right conspiracy theorist may have been involved. Attila Hildmann, who has spread conspiracy theories about the COVID-19 pandemic, has also claimed that one of the five museums, the Pergamon Museum, is home to the throne of Satan. So, very scary. We'll find out what's going on. Yeah. So it's going to be, it's a bit weird, a bit scary. Basically, the oily liquid sprayed onto dozens of artifacts has caused damage and left stains. A museum worker told Berliner Morgenpost that most of the damage was superficial. Some of it we had to use a torch to find. The museum's targeted included the Pergamon Museum, which is home to the renowned Pergamon Altar erected by King Eumenes II in the 2nd century BC. Pergamon was an ancient Greek city in Asia Minor, or modern-day Turkey. Local reports said 9th century BC sculpture had been attacked along with a 3D exhibit of the original Pergamon Altar, which is currently under renovation. Artifacts were also attacked in the Neues Museum, Alte Nationalgalerie, and elsewhere. The Neues Museum is home to a bust of Egyptian pharaoh Nefertiti. Museum Island has been targeted in the past, back in March 2017. Yeah, torch, I think they're talking about a flashlight. Yeah, 100% correct. I envisioned when I first read this that they were out there with a flamethrower, but that's probably not the best way to treat artifacts. We'll go over here, ask our friends at France 24 for some news, and we've got something out of Brazil. Brazil's health minister said Tuesday the country would add the Chinese-made CoronaVac vaccine against COVID-19 to its national immunization program, despite a political and diplomatic row over whether to use it. Health Minister Eduardo Pazuello said the federal government had reached a deal with Sao Paulo State, which is helping test and produce the vaccine, to buy 46 million doses to be administered starting in January. This vaccine will be Brazil's vaccine. In addition to another developed by Oxford University and pharmaceutical firm AstraZeneca, Pazuello told a video meeting of the South American country's 27 governors. That's our big news. This is going to recalibrate the process of eventually vaccinating Brazil's population against COVID-19, which has claimed more lives here than any country except the United States. What do those... Yeah. It's very interesting. I want to... We're talking about the story, the museum story in Calm. I just wanted to throw out that the NPR story, when I heard it on the radio... They mentioned that one of the conspiracy theories was that it was like somehow like a human sacrifice, and that was why COVID-19 was in the state. So it's very interesting. But just to go back to CoronaVac, sorry, I get sidetracked. CoronaVac, developed by Chinese pharmaceutical firm Sinovac Biotech, has been caught up in a messy battle in Brazil. Far-right President Jair Bolsonaro had labeled it the vaccine from that other country and resisted using it, pushing for the Oxford vaccine instead. Sao Paulo Governor João Doria, a top Bolsonaro opponent, meanwhile pushed a deal between Sinovac and Brazil's Butantan Institute to test and produce the vaccine in his state. Doria has touted the vaccine as safe and effective, personally holding the press conferences to announce preliminary results from the clinical trials. He and Bolsonaro have also clashed over whether vaccination should be compulsory, as Doria would like. The vaccine will not be obligatory, period, Bolsonaro said Monday. Both Sinovac and Oxford vaccines are currently undergoing final-stage clinical trials in Brazil, a top testing ground for vaccine candidates because of its high infection rate. Both still need regulatory approval. So we'll see what happens there. It seems like Chinese-made vaccines are a hot commodity right now. Oh, this was just a little neat side note. Iceland's Prime Minister Katrin Jakobsdóttir kept calm as a 5.5 magnitude earthquake interrupted her live TV interview with the Washington Post. The earthquake was centered near Krýsuvík, south of the capital of Reykjavík. No injuries had been reported. But if you go to the BBC, it is a kind of a neat little video because... You know, they're just doing the interview, and then it's like, everything's shaking. All right, let's keep going. And so it was pretty rad. Anyway, it's always cool when people treat extraordinary events kind of like they're normal. Oh, whoops. See, you hit Control-U. If you're in Calm, and you have your mouse over the window, and you hit Control-U, that can... Well, if you scroll your mouse and you get a bunch of garbage there, you can hit Control-U to undo or reset your line. But if you do that in Firefox, that opens up the web inspector. So I keep our view source. So sorry about that. Next up, we got a story from Reuters. Britain will resume talks with the European Union on Thursday, making a new push by the two sides to protect billions of dollars worth of trade for the beginning of next year. What's weird, and why I wanted to bring this up, is they just said that the freaking Boris just got through saying, yeah, just prepare for no deal. We're done. We're not going to do this. And then, you know, 12 hours later, oh, please, please, EU, help us. Don't make us get hurt. And it's, anyway, it's getting annoying. So Prime Minister Boris Johnson walked away from the negotiations late last week after British officials criticized conclusions from an EU summit, which they suggested only London should compromise to try and secure a new trade deal. With just 10 weeks until a status quo Brexit transition period is due to end, both sides have traded blame and called on each other to offer more concessions in the talks, which have all but deadlocked since the summer. But while markets welcomed the resumption, it is unclear whether the two sides can bridge gaps on fair competition guarantees, especially state aid rules, and fisheries, a sector laden with symbolism for Brexit supporters in Britain. A spokeswoman for Johnson's Downing Street office said Britain's chief negotiator, David Frost, had spoken to an EU counterpart, Michael Barnier, and welcomed his comments from earlier in the day. A spokeswoman for... On the basis of that conversation, we are ready to welcome the EU team to London to resume negotiations later this week. We have jointly agreed a set of principles for handling this intensified phase of talks. It's clear that the significant gaps remain between our positions in the most difficult areas, but we are ready with the EU to see if it's possible to bridge them in intensive talks. So, we shall see what happens there. It's a pretty interesting. Oh, wow. Anon Radio's a thing by the Keys. That's neat. Pressing buttons. That's not what I wanted. All right. We're almost done with our world news, and then we'll play a song. Oh, man. I'm feeling very mellow, and I believe it's due to my jasmine oolong tea. I'm on the third steeping, and oh, so good. I used more leaves this time, and oh, buddy. Anyway, oolong tea. Good stuff. All right. From Reuters, Thai Prime Minister Prayuth Chan-Ocha backed down on Wednesday over emergency measures he imposed last week to stop 3 months of protests, but demonstrators said it was not enough and demanded he resign within 3 days. Tens of thousands of people marched to his offices at the government house. The protesters have been demonstrating for months against Prayuth and to demand curbs to King Maha Vajiralongkorn's powers. In a televised address, Prayuth said he was ready to lift measures banning political gatherings of 5 or more people and publication of information deemed to threaten security. I will make the first move to de-escalate the situation. I'm currently preparing to lift the state of severe emergency in Bangkok, and will do so promptly if there are no violent incidents. We must now step back from the edge of the slippery slope that can easily slide to chaos, he added, saying talks should go to Parliament, where his supporters have a majority. At his office, demonstrators handed over a mock resignation letter. They claimed success after an official took it inside. Oh, heck yeah. Publius has a cool note. Cosmonauts on the International Space Station used loose-leaf tea to find and repair an air leak. Oh, good luck. I hope, good luck, Zeptar. I hope you land that job. So let's keep on rolling. Vietnam is currently getting flooded. Millions of people in Vietnam face a deadly double disaster as the country, already suffering from COVID-19, battles its worst floods for decades, the Red Cross says. Flooding and landslides this month have killed over 100 people, and many of them soldiers, and left dozens more missing. Everywhere we look, homes, road, and infrastructure have been submerged. Vietnam has been severely hit by rainfall in the recent weeks. More rain is expected in the coming days, raising fears that floodwaters could rise further. And then the BBC has some great photos of the flood and the impact there. Okay, let's see. Oh, we've got two more world stories. I'll read them quickly. First thing, France 24 is letting us know the UN judge has ordered extradition of Rwandan genocide suspect Kabuga to The Hague. A UN judge on Wednesday ruled that the suspect Felicien Kabuga, who had been in a French jail since May, should be sent to a detention unit in The Hague ahead of his trial. So, I hereby amend the arrest warrant and order of transfer. Judge, I can't see if that's an I or an L. I'm going to assume it's an I. Judge Ian Bonamy said from Arusha, Tanzania, I consider that there are exceptional circumstances and that it would be in the interest of justice to send Kabuga to The Hague. The decision means that Kabuga 84 is likely to spend at least several months in The Hague and be brought before an international judge there for an initial appearance in his war crimes case rather than Tanzania as originally planned. And, of course, the Pope did something, so we got to talk about it. This is from the AP. A day after donning a face mask for the first time during a liturgical service, Pope Francis was back to his maskless old ways. Wednesday, despite surging coronavirus infections across Europe and growing criticism of his behavior in the example he's setting, Francis shunned a face mask again during his Wednesday general audience in the Vatican Auditorium and didn't wear one when he greeted a half dozen maskless bishops at the end. He shook hands and leaned in to chat privately with each one, while the clerics wore masks while seated during the audience. All but one took his mask off to speak to the Pope. Only one kept it on, and by the end of his tete-a-tete with Francis, had lowered it under his chin. Vatican regulations now require face masks to be worn indoors and out, where distancing can't be always guaranteed. The Vatican hasn't responded to questions why the Pope wasn't following either Vatican restrictions or basic public health measures to prevent COVID-19. So we'll find out what's going on. But until then, let's go ahead and play a song. We'll kind of chill out and see what's going on, you know. I think that today is a, how would I say it? Today is an anti-flag day. I'm feeling a little grumbly in my heart, if you know what I mean. This song is called This Is the End.
Listening to Anon Radio, powered by SDF Public Access UNIX System.
That's right. And we've only got about 10 minutes before it's time to convene the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe. It's every day at 19:30 UTC. Of course, right now, though,
it is time for tech news.
That's right. We got a tech news story for you. Right here, coming from The Guardian, Google Pixel 4a 5G review. So the 4a is the phone, 5G is the cellular technology. And the headline says, cheaper with two-day battery. What could they be talking about? The new Pixel 4a 5G is Google's cheaper but larger 5G phone and might just be the best. It's available in black and costs £499, fitting in between the £599 Pixel 5 and the £349 Pixel 4a. While the Pixel 4a 5G shares most of the same internal components with the Pixel 5, the look, feel, and black plastic body matches the smaller Pixel 4a, just made larger. The Pixel 4a 5G has a 6.2-inch FHD Plus OLED screen. That's Foxtrot Hotel Delta Plus OLED screen. Not sure what that stands for, so spell it out. It looks good, but it won't trouble the best from Samsung, OnePlus, or Apple. The screen is flanked by stereo speakers that make video watching and landscape really good. The body is a soft-touch plastic and feels solid in the hand, but a little cheap compared with metal and glass rifles. Most users will put it in the case anyway. At 168 grams, the phone is fairly light and well-balanced for its size. There's even the lesser-spotted headphone jack socket on the top, but the 4a 5G lacks water resistance. The cool part is there's a two-day-long battery. The 4a 5G has the same upper-middle-range Qualcomm Snapdragon 765G processor as the Pixel 5, but slightly less RAM with just 6 GB. It means it has a faster processor than the smaller 4a. Where's the battery? Battery life is very good, lasting more than 48 hours between charges with the screen on for about 6 hours and using 5G for 2 hours and 4G for 3 hours, with the rest spent on Wi-Fi during that time. That means even with my relatively heavy usage, the Pixel 4a 5G lasts from 7 a.m. on day 1 until at least 7 a.m. on day 3. Wow, X1 doesn't even have a phone. That's pretty wild. Oh, and just to be clear, in the space station, they found the hole with the T. They used Kapton tape to repair it. So, that's pretty rad. Alright. So, that's going to be our tech news. You know, there's other stuff going on. But, we've only got so much time. We've got a little under 7 minutes to go. So, I want to talk about I have a bunch of long form news stories I usually don't get to, but I wanted to be sure and talk about this one because, well, I think it's important. So this is from Rewire News Group, rewirenewsgroup.com. Okay. Chief Justice John Roberts' abortion time bomb goes off in Kentucky. So, less than 4 months after helping Louisiana abortion clinics open, John Roberts could be the reason clinics in Kentucky are forced to close. The time for celebrating Supreme Court's ruling in June Medical Services versus Russo is over, and you have embattled Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron to thank for it. In late June, when the Supreme Court struck down Act 620, Louisiana's law forcing abortion providers to get admitting privileges at a local hospital, abortion rights advocates celebrated the win. It was a victory for abortion rights in Louisiana, since access wouldn't be further decimated. And it was a victory for the providers who had tried and failed to get admitting privileges at hospitals that were either outright hostile to abortion or saw no point in granting privileges to doctors who rarely admit patients with complications. Surprise, because abortion's widely safe. But advocates knew that the celebration would be short-lived. Yes, John Roberts had voted with the liberals on the court, and in doing so had saved the remaining clinics, but he did so with a wink and a nod to anti-choice advocates. Well, the other shoe's dropped. It's barely 4 months later, and Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron, along with a couple of Trump judges from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, wants you to know that the law, almost identical to the ones the Supreme Court just struck down in Louisiana, are still on the table. So let's explain how. June Medical Services was a case about a Louisiana trap law. Generally, trap laws, those that stand for targeted regulation of abortion providers, are designed to shut down clinics. In June Medical Services, the trap law required providers in Louisiana to maintain admitting privileges at a local hospital. That law was modeled on an identical law in Texas, and lawmakers in both states gleefully and publicly admitted that their clinic shutdown laws were meant to do just that, shut down clinics. But if there is a trap law that wasn't a clinic shutdown law? What if instead of shutting down clinics, the law kept them in a perpetual state of licensing limbo? Which is where it gets really interesting. So enter Kentucky, which was able to sneak its clinic shutdown law past a three-judge panel of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals thanks to an argument that Cameron crafted after he intervened legalese for Push's way into the case. The two judges who sided with Cameron are unsurprisingly Trump judges. Cameron, who was somehow managed to avoid a national scandal after reportedly lying about the investigation into Breonna Taylor's murder, asked the court if he could intervene because, although the state legislature is controlled by Republicans, Kentucky's governor, Andy Beshear, is a Democrat, and he's demonstrated he's not going to waste Kentucky taxpayer money defending bullshit abortion restrictions. Wow, these guys don't pull any punches here. Cameron has no such reservations. In documents filed with the Sixth Circuit, Cameron argued that Kentucky's transfer agreement law was different than the laws in Louisiana and Texas. It's a cynical and, quite frankly, ridiculous interpretation of a law that amounts to a little more than harassment of the abortion providers. Under Kentucky law, abortion providers must have a transfer agreement with a local hospital in the same county or within a 20-minute drive of the clinic. A transfer agreement is, for all intents and purposes, the same as an admitting privileges agreement. It means a clinic has an arrangement with a hospital to transfer patients suffering complications from abortion to a specific hospital. Even though very few patients suffer complications, and paramedics will be the ones who do to whatever hospital is closest. We'll take the ones. Yeah, that makes sense. But wait, I thought the Supreme Court already decided that admitting privilege laws serve no medical benefit. You're right. In 2016's Whole Woman's Health versus Helderstedt, Stephanie Breyer, writing for the majority of the court, said that admitting privilege laws are nonsense. The technical term for nonsense in this context is an undue burden, but nonsense is what it is. Breyer took a look at the benefits that Texas claimed the law would have for pregnant people and weighed them against burdens the law would impose. That's what the undue burden test in Planned Parenthood versus Casey requires. After that calculus, Breyer determined that the law was an undue burden. After all, it would have closed most clinics in the state. In June Medical Services, Breyer deployed the same logic. The law in Louisiana, like in Texas, would have shut down nearly every clinic in Louisiana. But in his concurring opinion in June Medical Services, Roberts donned his monocle and top hat and huffed. But what did the Casey court really say before explaining that the undue burden analysis in Casey doesn't require weighing the benefits and burdens that the majority in Whole Woman's Health had said was necessary? In Roberts' view, Casey asked one question: is the law a substantial obstacle? He was content to answer in the affirmative when it came to Louisiana's law, because it was a clinic shutdown law. But what if a state passed an admitting privileges law that didn't shut down clinics, that just made it an absurd pain in the ass for abortion clinics to stay in business? That's what's happening in Kentucky. Kentucky's law requiring abortion clinics to have a transfer agreement in order to maintain their license has a loophole that allows officials in the state to slowly lower the sword of Damocles over clinics' heads without ever truly dropping it. Officials can extend a waiver to a clinic having difficulty securing a transfer agreement if the official feels like it. It's at their discretion. The waiver permits the clinic to continue operating for 90 days. And considering that the clinics in Kentucky haven't had much success in obtaining these agreements, the law essentially forces these clinics to apply for a waiver of the transfer agreement every 90 days, while unceasingly trying to convince a hospital to enter into a transfer agreement. Because if officials in Kentucky get the sense the clinics aren't just trying enough, they can refuse to extend the waiver. It's a bonkers system. It's really wild. But anyway, I just really thought this was important because it's like, wow, this is the kind of stuff that I think is really neat and it doesn't get enough attention. So I'm glad we got to talk about it. We're at time. We've got about a minute to go. The only other thing I would say is there's an absurd thing going on in Montana. To avoid quarantining students, the school district is moving them around every 15 minutes. That's right. The strategy is based on the definition of a close contact requiring quarantine, being within 6 feet of an infected person for 15 minutes or more. So if the students are moved around within that time, the thinking goes, no one will have to had close contact and be required to go home if a classmate tests positive. So that's pretty wild. That's a 16,000 student school.
Our time's come to an end. Thanks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow and every weekday, Monday through Friday, before the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe at 1900 UTC. Talk to you then.
7, 6.